فیلم فقه از علوم شریفه اسلامی است.
فقه و jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
Self-purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amoli. Stay tuned.
شیطان الرجیم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحیم. رخداد تلخی که اخیراً جامعه بشری را
I seek refuge with Allah from Satan, the outcast. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. The bitter events which have lately engulfed humanity, that is, the uninvited coronavirus disease, is in accordance with the absolute mercy of Allah.
چه بهتر که انسان به جایی برسد که جوامع دیگر در کنار سفره او بنشینه. این رب زدنی علمای رسول گرامی برای همه ما اسوه است.
How good would it be that humanity reaches a point where other societies sit down together at the tablecloth of food? This phrase, my nourisher, give me knowledge, was given to us by the Honorable Messenger who for us all is the best example. Allah in the Holy Quran, Surah 33, Ayah 11, orders us to obey the Messenger. Verily in the Messenger of Allah, you have a good example. This is one. Another important point is the ascending towards and descending from Allah. In the Qaws Sa'ud, or ascend from the world towards Allah, and not Qaws Nuzul, or the descent from Allah to the world, Prophet repeatedly said, My nourisher, give me knowledge. This happens because in the Qaws Nuzul, the Messenger contains everything where he comes from Allah, and is the apparent manifestation of Allah. Now, it's better that in the first session of recitation of dua, the esteemed physicians and the top-level physicians must pray to Allah for the divine grace for the discovery of medicine, the discovery of cures for the salvation of humanity, whether the Eastern world or the Western world, whether a Muslim or a non-Muslim, and to have mercy upon all the people so that all of humanity benefits from you and your discovery of the cure. This is what we call the knowledgeable and scholarly dua, which is usually from the side of the experts.
امیدواریم ذات اقدس اله نزاع ما را جامعه ما را مخصوصا بزرگوار و بزرگان پزشکی ما را که در خط مقدم
We are hopeful that the exalted being of Allah protects our Islamic system, our society, and especially the greatly esteemed physicians who are on the front line of this danger, protects them from all harms and removes this disease and virus from humanity. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Javadi Amali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
America.
Part 4.
From the earliest days, freedom of the press was what defined America. Thomas Jefferson, who helped write the Declaration of Independence, believed a free media was essential for a free nation, saying, "Were it left to me to decide whether we should have a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, I should not hesitate a moment to prefer the latter." That was in 1787. Today, our newspapers seem to be fading in importance in a multimedia world that is largely owned and controlled by a handful of large media corporations.
I think we're probably the most media-dominated society in the world.
Jeff Cohn worked in major media. Now he's one of the industry's fiercest critics.
Half a dozen corporations own and control most of the mainstream media in our country. So if you're looking at who rules America or who owns America, it's the same people that propagandize to America.
The press and the outlets that report news or convey information are just a small slice of vast media empires producing entertainment products that also sell a way of life based on consumption.
When you look at who's on the boards of media corporations, they're also on the boards of U.S. oil companies, and they're on the boards of U.S. military contractors. So trying to study who owns America, you're really also, these are the people that own the media. We don't have a state media, but in some ways it's very much like a state media. It's the corporate state.
If this is true, then we can say that the American media doesn't just report news. As we'll see, it's not independent of the system, but a pillar of it. It reinforces the worldview and defends the interests of those who rule America. With new global digital enterprises like Google, Facebook, and Twitter growing in importance worldwide, U.S.-based media became a transnational force. The U.S. media companies are themselves owned in large part by hedge funds, mutual funds, and finance companies. Barry James Dyke is an asset manager who has studied media ownership.
The research which I've done is unequivocal, and I kind of stumbled into this, is that The media companies, the major media companies, i.e. the Disneys, the CBSs, the news corporations, all of them, this is all public documents, is that they're all owned by mutual fund companies. The majority shareholders are owned by mutual fund companies. So, and also, they also get a lot of their revenue from these companies. So you're never going to see any consistent criticism about these fund companies.
Are these companies investigated by the media?
No, they're not.
Are they responsible
to the public in some way? Are they accountable? Do the public really know what they're doing?
The public really doesn't have a clue. They really don't know what they're doing.
He has documented his findings with charts in his own book, The Pirates of Manhattan.
Well, people are not getting the truth.
What about the role of the media? Is the media helping to strengthen our democracy, or do you think it's helping to divide us?
Well, I think that's a great question. I think that, you know, there are a couple of things going on there. Obviously, you've got kind of cable channels that are, you know, in different camps, and they are not showing different points of view. You've got Fox News showing the right. You've got MSNBC showing the left. And so with a setup like that, you have Americans that are just kind of tuning in to the channel they want to listen to that, you know, kind of expresses their views, and you're not seeing kind of a mix of an opinion, a debate, anything like that. You've also got, you know, the shrinkage of the media. You've got less coverage of what's going on. And I think this is particularly concerning more around kind of state-based and local politics, where there's even less coverage of what's going on in politics.
But even as the world is known for its diversity, American media is not. Editorially and ideologically, the power elite tends to reflect the views of the government and the people who shape its views. Dissenting politicians like Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. have a hard time getting their views heard.
Who owns the media? How the media is translated? Some of the moguls and the titans of media and industry are part of the problem. They shape a narrative for the American people, a narrative that ultimately leads millions of people to vote for candidates based upon the narrative that they shape, based upon the talking heads that they control. And those Americans tend to vote and tend to engage the system on the basis of that which they hear. Media is a significant part of this problem.
Historian Eric Foner agrees. He says it's not just political bias at work, but what the media as a business feels it's forced to focus on to attract ratings and revenues.
Somehow, that idea of power behind the people in office is not really in our media very much. It's not really in people's minds very much. They personalize politics. Their personalities combating each other, but they don't look at who's behind the scenes.
Well, you're quite right that the media focuses on personalities, you know, and often the quirks of personality, Clinton's sexual escapades, or whether Obama was born in the United States or not, or Romney and his cars and whatever, you know, his not paying taxes and many other things. Those are not totally unimportant issues, but maybe it's the nature of the media today in and of itself, in that it has to go for the quick news. Deep investigative reporting is not emphasized as much as perhaps it was in the past. And, you know, you got to sell papers, and scandal sells papers, personality sells papers, celebrity sells papers. So you're right that, the larger nature of how the system operates tends not to get emphasized as much.
It's not even understood by many people.
Well, it's hard to understand. This is a very large country, over 300 million people, a very, very complicated economy and political system, so it's difficult to understand exactly how things operate. But I think, you know, in a certain sense, the anti-government sentiment, which is rife in this country, which is generally associated with the right wing, is also a response to the feeling. It's an inchoate feeling. It's not an analytical feeling, but it's a feeling that government is aloof. It is not responsive. It does not really represent the people. It represents some very particular interests, and that sense is pretty widespread in this country.
Media watch groups are also concerned about the lack of diversity within the media that makes it unrepresentative of the country it serves in racial, ethnic, and gender terms.
The unwritten credo of the New York Times is do not alienate those for whom we depend on for money and access.
Chris Hedges was an award-winning journalist for the New York Times, an American media star.
And that means the power elite and the financiers who advertise. But it's expandable. I mean, you have at least in the positions that I was in, the possibility to do journalism. Not that there aren't, you know, restrictions or constrictions, there are, and not that they can't be punishing.
Hedges' work is still very respected, but he believes that much of the press is ultimately a charade that covers up for power more than covers it, especially when reporting on elections.
Because the political theater, I mean, the personal narrative of the candidate, it's all irrelevant. It's meaningless. And people, we still play the game. Look, every totalitarian country I covered had elections. They all play the charade. I mean, even East Germany did. And that's the charade we play. And when we have a compliant corporate media that pretends that that charade is real. So I think... the problem is that the illusion still remains so powerful. People are changing, but the illusion is still so powerful that people confuse where power actually exists.
How does the New York Times cover the power centers that many people say rule America? Chris Spanos edits the New York Times Examiner that monitors the newspaper's content every day. He believes the paper has become an accomplice to the power elite.
The New York Times as an institution is almost like a mini nation. And the correspondents, the op-ed writers, the editors, they're almost like diplomats in how they carry themselves and their own self-importance and in the way that they communicate with other politicians and diplomats. And they are very influential.
Would you say that they're a disseminator of ideology in America, not just of information?
Absolutely. They disseminate a very particular ideology in that their readership is primarily managers and people who make around over $90,000 a year. And so they cater to a managerial perspective. And so they have a pro-management, when they're discussing labor relations, they often have a pro-management view, a pro-business view.
Financial journalists like Stacey Herbert and Max Kaiser found that many pro-business views in some media outlets were often uninformed, as they told me on a radio show.
From December 2008, so well after the collapse of Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, the markets tumbling 1,000 points in a day, and the head of BBC World News Business said, and we had a 10-episode contract, do you think the financial crisis will last all the way through these 10 episodes?
So in other words, the people actually in charge of planning the coverage are very uninformed themselves.
Well, the mainstream media are themselves deeply in debt. You know, the news organizations have become entertainified, and to compete, they take on enormous amounts of debt. So the bankers, they don't want to insult their creditors because they might cut off their lines of credit. So they don't have, they're not unbiased in this regard in any stretch of the imagination. You see this most spectacularly with the New York Times. Their coverage of the Wall Street is pitiful.
Welcome to my world.
One reason the press is so pro-business is that they are themselves businesses. The people who run media companies increasingly pay themselves huge salaries and bonuses the same way that bankers do, says Barry Dyke.
Yeah, Les Moonves, I couldn't believe he made $59 million in 2009, and he racked up, it was just as close the other day, that he made close to $70 million in 2010.
And that's the head of CBS.
That's the head of CBS.
But you're saying that all of them are really running their businesses as if they were banks.
I mean, that's pretty good. That's banker pay. I mean, $70 million is a lot of money in anyone's book, and that's what they're getting paid.
So the media companies are really part of this whole system of who rules America. They're part of these interconnecting, interlocking relationships with financial institutions.
There's no question about it. You get the media companies, which are huge. It's part of the empire. You get the media companies, you get the bankers, of course. You have your massive, unions, okay? You have other factors as well. But the media is definitely part of it, and the asset managers.
That's exactly it. The corporations that own the U.S. media and own U.S. television are very wealthy and very powerful. And the people at the top of the news networks get paid an awful lot of money. I have never earned anything close to the amount of money I earned in the 1 year I worked where General Electric was my boss at MSNBC. So what I think happens is a self-censorship where the people who rise to the top have learned how not to rock any boats, and they know if they do rock boats, they will lose their huge salaries.
Newspapers like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal tend to frame a deeper narrative that tells us what we should believe matters. They set the agenda that influences what TV news programs also cover. For example, they don't focus on inequality and class differences, says independent media executive Brian Drulé.
They don't talk about the working class, and part of it is, it's like the idea that, you know, they promote this idea that, you know, if you buy a lottery ticket, you could win, right? So you're already thinking that maybe you could win. So if you're in the working class, or you're part of the working class that's unemployed, you still have this hope that somehow you're going to go into the middle class.
There's been very little attention paid to class. I mean, you were saying that the media really doesn't discuss this. They don't really highlight class differences in America. They're much more comfortable talking about racial differences or ethnic differences. At the same time, in their business practices, they're very conscious of demographics. What class are they attracting? Upper class, how to cater their advertising, how to sell it.
No, they go, I mean, you know, the internet is a perfect example of that. Google and everything, where they're constantly slicing and dicing who you are, so they know exactly how much you make, so they can pitch what kind of products to you. But that's this whole sort of madness of the consumer society that's been created by modern capitalism. But the key thing I think that you're getting at is that even though there is a reality of class, a working class in this country, and a ruling class or a bourgeois class, people have been trained not to think in those terms, so they don't even know who they are.
Some networks, like Fox News, owned by Rupert Murdoch, seem to be more comfortable presenting a right-wing political line. They have helped shift many media outlets to the right.
There is a school of thought that says we should have given the citizens of Baghdad 48 hours to get out of Dodge and flatten the place. Then the war would be already over, and we could have done that in 2 days.
That may be so, but old media is being eclipsed by the new, says George Scribner, the vice president of Digitas, a company that comes up with digital strategies for big companies and studies how affluent consumers now drive marketing in an era of growing economic inequality.
The one thing that's different now is that the media is owned by everyone. You know, the thing that's kind of leveling off the dollars to some extent is that everyone has access to Twitter. Everyone has access to blogging. And there's this new kind of fast and fluid coalition building. Like Occupy Wall Street was one example of that. So in some ways, kind of there's a new check and balance. I don't think that's necessarily changing the restructuring of income and wealth, but I do think there's another trip switch that might help us when things get too bad.
So the digital media, in a
yes.
way, is where democracy
exactly.
is today. It's not in politics.
Yes.
It's not in big business. It's not in big money.
That's true. I think that's well said.
There is some debate on how free the internet really is, given corporate control and government censorship, but it does make possible more interactivity. At the same time, media attention still tends to revolve around a political elite with authority, even if that elite doesn't necessarily have the power to shape priorities or impose policies. But when you talk to ordinary Americans, many of them feel it's totally fair.
Yeah.
They're seeing different points of view. They're seeing people who are critical from time to time. They see the media as the liberal media in some instances.
I was in the Soviet Union, and we were always raised in this country that's pure propaganda. And frankly, it was very ineffective propaganda because they never pretended to have two points of view. They would have some one point of view saying how great things are. But in our country, propaganda is really effective because they have the appearance of debate.
Media does not often cover the people behind the scenes who run things, says William Hartung, who has written about the military-industrial complex.
You would think there would be some independence in the journalism on this issue. But in some cases, reporters have even said to me, well, you know, I can't go after the Pentagon harder or the companies harder. Or this nexus of influence harder because this company is a big advertiser in the paper, and we'll get pressure, you know, if we do those kinds of stories. So we'll do stories about the war in Afghanistan. We'll repeat what the president has to say on an issue, but there's not really a lot of interest or resources put into investigating these kinds of connections.
David Swanson, who also writes about military policy, agrees.
Well, the corporate media in the United States is integrated with the military-industrial complex. Some of the same corporations are making profits from both. There are two major political parties that don't have much disagreement on this topic, so it's not a topic for debate. No matter if 90% of the public is upset about it, it's not acceptable news.
Michael Clare, who's investigated the destructive power of oil and gas companies, says the same is true when it comes to that industry.
The media doesn't cover this for the most part. In fact, the media is largely in league because of the advertising dollars that the oil and gas lobby provides. They're very heavily dependent on advertising revenue, so they're very careful in what they say.
Big business, a wealthy and frequent advertiser in the media, is often not scrutinized by the media. That was the case in the financial crisis, says Sheila Krumholz of the Center for Responsive Politics.
So these are complicated issues. The issues are difficult to understand on a good day, and they seem, again, very arcane and unimportant to the average American. So it's possible that some media were laboring away trying to explain why this was critical information that the voters need. I think a lot of blame, though, can be laid at the feet of the media for the financial collapse. Ultimately, what we do know is that it's critical. If there's any perfect scenario that shows why transparency and paying attention and scrutinizing the powerful players and what they want and what they're doing to get their way, the financial crisis is that perfect example. It shows us how important transparency is.
Because significant wealth demands significant attention. Together we can give you and your wealth the wings to soar. Goldman Sachs Wealth Management.
At the same time, media has become so pervasive, online and off, on TV and on our mobile phones, that many Americans say they are becoming victims of information overload. The more they watch, the less they know.
For sure, information overload is, I think, a serious threat to democracy, because it doesn't work if people aren't vigilant. Nobody's going to hold members of Congress accountable for you. You have to make sure that you're heard. I think there's also the sense that because there is this tension, and some would say healthy tension, between concern about protecting the process, democracy, and government from money's undue influence, versus protecting freedom of speech and privacy. Nobody wants to censor information. We want our representatives to have all the information, even if it's coming from deep-pocketed corporations, unions, or trade associations, very narrow interests. We just want to make sure that they are doing their job to seek alternative perspectives, even if they're coming from groups that have no power and have no money.
Media criticism tends to revolve around what's being covered and not covered, and not on the way media narratives shape how we think and what we think about. That's the power of media and why it is now among the forces ruling America. Coming up in the next episode of Who Rules America, money now controls politics. Next time on Who Rules America.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند میکند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد میشید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, we said that Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsen Hakim, as a great source of emulation, defended the Iraqi and Iranian nations against the despotic and repressive regimes in the two countries. But his method of a struggle differed with that of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. However, Imam Khomeini highly respected him and didn't allow anyone to disrespect him. Today, we are going to continue the discussion. Imam Khomeini, during his stay in Holy Najaf, would consider Ayatollah Hakim as the head of the Najaf Seminary, and for some decisions and stances, he used to urge people to refer to him. Late Ayatollah Abbas Ali Amid Zanjani said on then Iraqi President Abdusalam Arif's effort to meet Imam Khomeini, "When the Imam arrived in Najaf, the Iraqi government decided to meet with the sources of emulation. President Arif wanted to raise somebody else to undermine the social status of Ayatollah Hakim. Thus, through the son of one of the sources of emulation, the Iraqi government claimed to have made every effort to glorify Imam Khomeini. The Iraqi government even claimed that the Iranian regime had told the Iraqi government to let the Imam be free in the country. Therefore, since the Iraqi government was respecting the Imam was expected to pay attention to the conduct and pay back the right. I told the issue to the Imam. He said, I will not meet with them as I am not such a person, as the head of the Najaf Seminary is Mr. Hakim. I am a student here, and this is up to him to decide. Eventually, it happened as the Imam wanted. Abdusalam Arif went on pilgrimage to Imam Ali's shrine, but he failed to meet any of the sources of emulation. Imam Khomeini paid a visit to Ayatollah Hakim while he was under pressure and a kind of house arrest by the Iraqi regime, and nobody dared to meet him. Of course, this visit cost dearly for the Imam, as his elder son, Haj Agha Mustafa, was arrested. When Ayatollah Hakim went to Baghdad in protest to the Ba'athist regime, Muslims from all over Iraq came to him in masses. This was a move against the regime. This was while the regime had besieged the area and closed the door of his house and would detain those who came there. Therefore, Ayatollah Hakim left for Kufa in protest and closed his classes. Thus, this great source of emulation passed away in loneliness. The ulema of Najaf refused to go to him out of fear from the regime. But Imam Khomeini used to visit him bravely and send Haj Agha Mustafa to his house every day. In one of the days, Haj Agha Mustafa was arrested and sent to Baghdad. He was in prison in Baghdad for 1 week, and nobody was informed of his whereabouts. In one of his meetings with Ayatollah Hakim, Imam Khomeini asked him to come out of isolation and let people visit him. Sayed Hamid Rouhani says in this regard, after the blow of Mr. Hakim to the Ba'athist regime, due to his support for the Iranian people in the issues related to the border disputes, the Iraqi people dispersed from him out of fear and left him alone. Mr. Hakim was confined at home and decided to stay home and not appear in public. Imam Khomeini realized that the decision was to the benefit of the regime, so visited him in Kufa and told him that isolation is not useful, as the leader and source of emulation should always be among the people. The Imam asked him to stay in Najaf, as it was somehow the center of leadership, and open his house's door for people. This proposal was accepted by Ayatollah Hakim to some extent. He would come to Najaf on Fridays for a pilgrimage to Imam Ali's shrine. Imam Khomeini was very sad at the demise of Ayatollah Hakim, so that he would not express his happiness for 1 year. Hujjatul Islam Sayyid Abbas Mohri says, after the demise of Ayatollah Hakim, I went to his son, Sayyid Yusuf, for extending my condolences. On the night that I was returning, I went to bid farewell to Imam Khomeini, as it was the eve of Eid Qadir. When I entered the Imam's room, I saw that he was studying with a small lamp over his head. I told him that it was the eve of Eid Qadir and people expect him to go outdoors to visit him. He said, "Do you know whom we have lost? We have lost Mr. Hakim. Shouldn't we respect him at least for 1 year? We don't have happiness and joy. Should we have joy after the departure of Mr. Hakim?" I felt shy and said, "Excuse me, I didn't know you are so careful." The Imam said, "It is obligatory for all to respect this great man." Dear listeners, during the sickness of Ayatollah Hakim, Imam Khomeini used to pray for him. These behaviors showed that the Imam highly revered him.
Around the World with Reporters.
The Islamic Jihad movement and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine held a sit-in in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. The event took place near the Israeli-controlled Erez Crossing in northern Gaza. The move comes as thousands of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to suffer from inhumane treatment and are being denied their basic rights. The Israeli regime has imprisoned nearly 1 million Palestinians since 1967. Many Palestinian prisoners suffer from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical treatment by Israel's prison service, who runs Israeli prisons.
The Islamic Jihad and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine came together today to express solidarity with the prisoners who are languishing in Israeli jails. The conditions of prisoners are only getting worse as days go by under the watchful eye of the international community.
Palestinian prisoners are subjected to degrading conditions, including administrative detention, solitary confinement, and bans on family visits. Palestinians say that Arab countries normalizing relations with the Israeli regime are encouraging Tel Aviv to violate the rights of Palestinians.
Denormalization by Arab regimes has badly affected the conditions of Palestinian prisoners. Normalization of ties with the Zionists is a betrayal of Palestine and the Palestinian prisoners. All Arabs must understand that the United States and Israel are the enemies of the Arab and Muslim nations.
Securing the release of prisoners is a highly emotive issue for Palestinians who regard them as prisoners of war and as symbols of resistance against Israeli occupation. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, PFLP, vowed to use all forms of resistance to free Palestinian prisoners.
The so-called peace deals will not free Palestinian prisoners. Only resistance can free Palestinian prisoners from Zionist jails. Capturing more Israeli soldiers to exchange them with Palestinian prisoners must be a top priority for all Palestinian resistance groups.
Statistics show that over 200 Palestinian detainees have died in Israeli prisons since 1967 due to medical negligence. According to prisoners' advocacy groups, Israel is currently holding some 5,000 Palestinians behind bars, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The Yemeni army says two of its drones hit Jizan Airport and King Khalid Air Base, both in southwestern Saudi Arabia. The army says this is part of intensified attacks to retaliate Riyadh's ongoing war on Yemen.
We are entitled to carry out the attacks as part of our normal and legitimate right to respond to the escalation of Saudi Arabia and its comprehensive blockade on our country. And we promise the Saudi regime more painful operations as long as the aggression and siege continues.
His comments come as over the past months, Saudi Arabia has either roundly denied any Yemeni attacks inside the country or claimed Yemeni missiles and drones were intercepted before making impact.
The Saudi regime realizes that it may lose face if people of the country come to know about the Yemeni attacks. The Saudi regime is controlling its people by force and it is afraid of an internal revolution against the ruling regime. So, this is why Riyadh continues to avoid talking about the Yemeni attacks.
Military experts say the Yemeni army is well capable of expanding its attacks to a wider range of targets to make them more painful for Riyadh. They say this could inflict greater damage to Saudi Arabia economically and militarily.
Saudi Arabia must realize that the painful phase is yet to come. Saudi Arabia will lose its economic power and military capabilities in this phase. Saudi Arabia says its army is the sixth most powerful army in the world, but 6 years of war on Yemen have proven that the Saudi army is extremely weak and has achieved nothing, while the Yemeni military capabilities have increased. And I believe that the continuation of this war is further damaging to the kingdom.
The Yemeni army's escalation of retaliatory attacks is a response to the deadly Saudi-led aggression and siege that caused the deaths of tens of thousands of people, many of them women and children.
Saudi Arabia has been calling for peace talks with Yemeni forces to stop their attacks while refusing to grant the demand to end its years-long war and siege on Yemen. This leaves the Yemeni army no option but to step up its retaliatory attacks against the kingdom. Abdul Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky held talks with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Istanbul. The visit comes amid tensions between Kiev and Moscow over Ukraine's eastern Donbas region. Meanwhile, Russia bulked up its military presence on Ukraine's eastern border, threatening military action. During the meeting, the two presidents spoke about ways of cooperation in different sectors and strengthening ties between the two countries, including free trade, tourism, and sports. Following the meeting, which was also attended by ministers from both sides, a number of agreements were signed.
Turkey strongly defends the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Ukraine. We hope that the escalation in eastern Ukraine will come to an end and the conflict will be resolved through dialogue based on the Minsk agreement.
The United States, after informing Turkey as per the Montreux Convention, sent two warships through Turkish straits towards the Black Sea. Turkish Foreign Ministry said the warships will stay in the Black Sea until May 4.
The tension between Russia and Ukraine is increasing every minute. Ukraine is waiting for support from the EU and the US. But Russia has clearly expressed that Crimea is its red line and will not give it to Ukraine. I think this visit is aimed at sorting things out. Ukraine wants to make sure that Turkey is on its side, especially after the phone call between Turkish and Russian presidents.
Late on Friday, Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed with his Turkish counterpart over the phone the Ukraine crisis and the presence of U.S. warships in the Black Sea. Turkish president assured that Ankara's cooperation with Ukraine does not mean it is against Russia. Analysts believe Turkey is trying to play the role of peacemaker in the region without taking sides. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
It was an utter shock for the destitute Rohingya community in India after the country's Supreme Court rejected the petition seeking halt on the deportation process. The court in its ruling said the deportation process could go ahead as long as the government follows due process. Now more panic has gripped the community as their last hope seems lost. Experts say the Supreme Court ruling will give a sense of relief to the community for a while from being deported instantly. They, however, believe the ruling doesn't stop the detention process. Rather, it gives government more freedom to act swiftly. Legal experts are shocked about the judgment, saying the country has welcomed refugees from several countries since decades, but adopted a hostile approach towards Rohingya in particular. India has no legislation on the refugees, and it considers Rohingya as illegal immigrants and a threat to national security.
They can be deported in accordance with the law. Now, which law? Law, according to the government, means the Foreigners Act. Now, Foreigners Act doesn't deal with refugees. Refugees are a different category of people. We had argued that even non-citizens, even refugees, have Article 21 rights, the right to life.
In recent weeks, dozens or more refugees were detained from New Delhi. The police maintains they have orders from higher authorities to carry detention process. Now grief has befallen the destitute community. Rights activists say treating these refugees differently is a blow on India's ethos of Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family.
Why is it not our concern if there are refugees coming from there? It's not just the refugee law. There are so many laws dealing with the rights of children, the Human Rights Convention, the Civil and Political Rights Convention. They all talk about the principle of non-refoulement, which means that you cannot send somebody to a country or outside your territory where there will be danger to his life or limb.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India, escaping genocide in their country. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
As the fourth wave of the coronavirus hits Iran, the country goes under another nationwide lockdown. From Saturday on, for at least 10 days, travel to and from high-risk cities will be banned, and non-essential businesses have to roll down their shutters. Schools, entertainment centers, and all public places will also be closed. Officials have avoided a total lockdown in Tehran, arguing that the capital city accommodates major national and international activities. The closures come amid a new wave of infections across Iran, which is believed to be the UK variant of COVID-19, entering the country from neighboring Iraq.
The first reason why our hospitals are once again overwhelmed with COVID-19 patients is the fact that British variant of the virus slipped into our country through our Khuzestan and Iran borders with Iraq. Now we are unfortunately faced with a fourth wave of the pandemic.
Authorities blame the new spike on the two-week traveling spree during the Persian New Year holidays, which started on March 21st. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Iran has passed the 2 million mark, and the total fatalities have surpassed 64,000. Vaccination of the most vulnerable groups of the society is underway in Iran with Russian-made Sputnik V vaccine. But the country is yet to launch a nationwide vaccination program. The government hopes to kickstart mass inoculation in 2 months using its own homegrown jabs.
While vaccines have also come in the ring to join the fight against COVID-19, the virus is still hard to knock out. Health officials advise everyone to take the new restrictions seriously. As they say, chances of survival are much lower for those who get infected with the UK variant of the coronavirus. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Dates, one of the fruits of paradise in Islamic tradition. With their paper-thin skin and juicy, sweet flesh, they have pride of place, especially on Muslim dinner tables.
Walk into any halal shop or indeed any supermarket here in the UK and you're bound to see dates on display. They come from many different places, including from Palestinian territories. And during Ramadan, they simply fly off the shelf. But could the Muslims living here in Britain, by taking dates to break their fast during the holy month, be unknowingly supporting the brutal Israeli occupation of Palestinians?
We put that question to the head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, an NGO running a campaign to boycott Israeli dates in the UK, now Israel's third target market.
They were breaking their fast on a date which is being grown on stolen land, which is actually even unlawful, to break your fast with something which is haram.
Israel is one of the world's top five exporters of dates. In 2018, the UK was Israel's largest market for dates worth more than $25 million. Over half of those are grown in illegal settlements, ruled by the United Nations, the International Court of Justice, and several other international organizations as illegal and built on stolen Palestinian land. Not only that, Israeli settlers are set to employ low-paid Palestinian laborers, among them children, to do the back-breaking job of picking the dates. But how are Muslims and non-Muslim Palestinian rights activists to ensure that the dates they're eating are not from the illegal Israeli settlements?
Israelis, instead of coming out and saying product of Israel, they are hiding the identity of the dates. Packages like this, you know, Al-Malik, you know, a Muslim name, Arabic writing, product of Palestine. But when you look, you realize it's a con, because there is no company importer or distributor attached to this.
This year's call to boycott Israeli dates subscribes to the mission of the Global Boycott, Divestment and Sanctions Movement that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law.
We were in Britain number one importer of Israeli dates. Last year we informed everyone that we have become second, and this year we have become third. And at the same time, Palestinian dates are being supported and imported more.
This Ramadan, when Muslims in Britain break their fast with dates, they'll be wise to ask themselves if the dates they're eating are helping ease the suffering of Palestinians, or are they going towards oppressing them? Saeed Puriza, London.
A shock end to the week as British royal Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, was pronounced dead on Friday. Just hours after the news broke, mourners began gathering to lay flowers for the late Duke of Edinburgh, who was the longest-serving consort in British history.
Following the death of such a prominent member of the royal family, British media, particularly the BBC, appear to have gone into whitewash overdrive, portraying the prince as some kind of charitable war hero, whilst totally glossing over his various disgraces, including his numerous racist outbursts and his support for colonialism.
Both headlines and government statements were awash with complimentary tributes. But British social media reacted very differently, with Black and Irish Twitter hashtags going viral, two groups competing to mock the royals' scandal-ridden legacy.
His record is incredibly checkered. He has indulged in numerous racist outbursts,
and has indeed been a champion of British colonialism.
He said, for instance, back in 2002, a group of indigenous Australians, while on a visit to see them with the Queen, he asked them, do you still throw spears at each other?
The British monarchy represents everything bad in their history, and so quite understandably, they have a different viewpoint on his death and what it means.
He said, if you stay here much longer, you will all be slitty-eyed. That's what he told British exchange students who lived in Xi'an in 1986.
The prince had a bad habit of offending minorities, but also represented detested British imperialist values.
If we're going to swear an oath of allegiance to anybody, it should be an oath of allegiance to the people. To the people that elect us. We're all living in a democracy. We shouldn't be swearing an oath of allegiance, it seems to me, to a unelected monarchy.
150,000 COVID dead, 10 years of austerity, 120,000 of the most vulnerable and poor people dead. That's who I shed a tear from.
For now, the flag at the palace has been lowered, and on Monday, Parliament will honour the Duke with further tributes. But no matter how hard the establishment ignore it, the British royal legacy is tarnished. Robert Carter, London.
A joint commission session between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA comes to an end in Vienna. Iran's lead delegate, Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi, says Iran's demand is clear. It will only come back to full compliance with the agreement after the U.S. lifts sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled following the U.S. withdrawal from the JCPOA. And Iran will also want to verify the sanctions lifting.
What we mean by verification is to see the effects of sanctions lifting in practice. So it is not enough for the U.S. to sign, you know, waivers or, I don't know, executive orders, whatever. Yes, they have to officially sign, but what matters for us is to see the effect of sanction lifting on the ground.
China's representative said the sides are narrowing down their differences. He said Beijing believes all the nuclear-related unilateral U.S. sanctions are illegal and should be lifted immediately to safeguard the JCPOA. The demand to lift all sanctions at once is a legitimate one, he said.
We think it's legitimate for them to lift it all at once, and it's an important issue.
But will they do it?
They have undertaken to do it, but we say that they must put it into action, turn their commitments into action.
Araghchi said he believes it is possible to get the job done sooner rather than later, but it depends on how willing and serious the other side is. After 3 days of intensive discussions within two working groups, the delegates agreed the talks are moving in the right direction. The Joint Commission will meet again on Wednesday amid hopes to maintain momentum. Homolesky, Vienna.
Turkey has reported an unprecedented surge of daily coronavirus cases. The new infections stood at almost 55,000 on Wednesday, as the highest in the country since the outbreak of the pandemic last year. Turkish government plans to reduce the numbers during the upcoming holy month of Ramadan to welcome tourists again after the month. Turkish president said that he wants to see a significant reduction in the number of coronavirus infections by the end of Ramadan, as he announced last week that during the holy month, restaurants and coffee shops' work will be limited to takeout and delivery services only. Meanwhile, Turkey will continue to witness a daily curfew from 9 p.m. till 5 a.m. and total weekend lockdowns.
We aim to give a rest to our country during Ramadan and prepare it for better days after the Eid. If we could decrease the number of the cases to thousands, we will be able to catch the tourism season that is understood to be opened in May and the commercial activity that will be created by the tourism season.
Turkish Health Minister Fahrettin Koca said earlier that 75% of the new coronavirus cases in the country are from the more contagious variant detected in Britain. This as the country is still open for tourists who are not included in the curfew and lockdown measures. Some analysts believe the latest measures is the reason behind the sudden increase in the new cases.
We expected to see a spread of the virus amid the third wave. However, we didn't expect to see such high numbers, especially after we began public vaccination. Turkish government's trying to create a balance between people's health and economy.